Hi everyone, this is Ian. It's June now and the weather hasn't been as good as in May, but here's another edition of Angus Talking News to brighten your day. In this month's collection of news from around Angus, read as always by our volunteers, we start with Leslie reading from the paper of the 22nd of May, then Jenny reading from the edition of the 29th of May, followed by Julie with selections from the most recent edition, that of the 5th of June. And as an extra at the end, you can listen to an article connected to the recent commemorations of the end of the Second World War 80 years ago. In this interview from the Talking News Federation, Rob from St Albans Talking Newspaper talks to Olga Hopkins about her memories of the war, Victory in Europe Day, Victory in Japan Day, and her recent trip to Buckingham Palace to join the King and Queen's VE Day celebrations. I hope you find this article and the news items interesting. Before I go and pass you over to the readers, could I, as usual, appeal to all of you, please be sure to return the yellow pochette you received this recording in. And also, please put in the pochette and return the USB stick, if that is how you listen to it. If you receive the CD, there is no need to return it, but please do return the pochette. All you need to do is reverse the label on the pochette and get it posted. There's no need for a stamp. So enough of this blethering. I will be back next month, then in August Stacey will be here to do the honours. For now, let's get on with the news. Goodbye.
Hello everyone, this is Leslie reading from the Angus County Press from Thursday, May 22nd. Council raises flag to stand by Ukraine. Angus Council has shown its support for and solidarity with Ukraine by raising the country's flag at its Forfar headquarters. The occasion also marked the beginning of what is hoped will be an enduring sister town area relationship between Sumy Oblast and the Angus Council. The relationship will aim to develop human and cultural relations between both areas and to establish a firm foundation for future understanding, respect and friendship between their people. Councillor Lloyd Melville raised the flag at Orchard Bank, where he was joined by Provost Craig Frotheringham, Council Leader George Meekin and Veterans Champion Councillor Ronnie Proctor. Councillor Bill Duff, Leader of the Opposition, also attended. An Angus Council meeting on the 20th March. At that meeting, Mr. Bill Melvin, seconded by Major Proctor, proposed the flying of the flag and friendship agreement. His motion, which was unanimously agreed, called on the local authority to unequivocally condemn Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine and acknowledge the right of Ukraine as a sovereign nation to exist as an independent, democratic state, free from the threat of aggression by its neighbours. The motion also urged the UK government to increase aid to Ukraine to ensure it can continue to defend itself, expressed support for the country's brave and determined people and its military, called on the council to continue its work with Scottish and UK governments in welcoming and supporting people from Ukraine to settle in Angus for as long as they need to, and enter into a friendship agreement with Sumy Oblast. Councillors agreed that the flag will fly at Orchard Bank for the duration of the continued war and occupation of Ukraine's territories. Butcher celebrating gold awards. Arbroath butchers D.H. Robertson struck gold with their special products from this summer in the recent Craft Butcher Awards. The business enjoyed success in the awards evaluation for speciality burgers and make it with haggis that were judged at Forth Valley College in Stirling last month. The success came with gold award for their pork and mango sausages and pork black pudding and beetroot sausages in the speciality sausage category. They were delighted to be presented with the awards at the recent event. There were 161 entries in the speciality sausage category, and there were also 139 entries in the make it with haggis category. New deal with Co-op. Award-winning Angus drinks producer Bothy Trading has announced a major trade partnership with the Scottish Co-op Group, with hip flask spirits and gunshot whiskey now being stocked in 107 stores across Scotland. The deal marks the second national retailing listing for the hip flask brand, which also launched last year in select Morrison's stores. Kim Cameron, Bothy Trading founder, said, "We created our hip flask spirits and gunshot whiskey range to allow us to supply multiple retailers with a market entry lifestyle range while keeping our gin Bothy and rum Bothy ranges to more independent retailers. This strategy has allowed us to compete with national brands, and we're excited to see how these brands can now grow. Our team has already visited over half the Co-op stores from Skye to Stirling to support the national rollout and strengthen local relationships." Bothy Trading was founded by Kim Cameron and began with her original spirit, Gin Bothy. What started as a small batch spirit made using traditional methods and local ingredients has grown into one of Scotland's leading drinks brands, selling more than 70,000 units annually around the world. Today, Gin Bothy sits alongside Hip Flask Spirits, Gunshot Whiskey, the Jam Bothy, Bothy Butter, and the upcoming Bothy Distillery, set to open in Glenprozen later this year as part of the Bothy Trading portfolio. Club secures late night license for music festival. An Angus nightclub has been allowed to extend its opening hours during the Montrose Music Festival. The annual event has run since 2008, and this year it took place between May 23rd and 25th. An array of local artists showcased their talent, including bands, DJs, solo performers, and entertainers. Montrose nightclub Utopia on George Street lodged an application with Angus Council to extend its business during the weekend of festivities. The local authority's licensing committee approved the application. This means Utopia will be able to stay open until 3 a.m. during the festival. Councillor Tommy Stewart said, "The festival is a fantastic event and the money that it generated in the town over the weekend is good. Not just for the pubs, it's good for the hotels, restaurants, caravan park and the shops too. Everyone benefits from it." Visit to Falklands. A party of former serving Royal Marines travelled to Port Stanley in the Falkland Islands recently to revisit sites connected to the Falklands War. All of them are veterans of the 1982 conflict, which took place after Argentina forces illegally landed on the British sovereign territory in the South Atlantic. A task force was ordered by the then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher to sail to the Falklands and take the islands. The war lasted 74 days from April 2nd to June 14th, with Arbroath-based 45 Commando playing a major part in the conflict. By the end of the war, in total, 255 British troops were killed, including 13 based at RM Condor. The group flew with the RAF, which operates a flight to the Falklands most years, in which veterans can book a place to visit the islands and honour those who never returned. And there's a group of the veterans pictured here wearing their berets and other medals. Higher rates for taxi fares. Angus is set for a double-digit rise in taxi fares after a review of current rates led to a range of proposals being put forward to the local authority's recent civic licensing committee meeting. Members subsequently agreed proposals put forward by Neil Gibson of Lorimer Cabs in Montrose. The daytime tariff will raise from £4.40 to £4.90 for the first mile, an increase of 11%. Daytime rates for longer distances would rise between 8 to 10%, and evening tariffs will rise from £5.50 to £6 for the first mile. During Thursday's meeting, Mr. Gibson said an increase is vital for the area's taxi operators to stay afloat. He added that the proposed fares were the maximum tariffs which Angus taxis could charge, so it's still open to taxi firms to charge lower fares. Council leader George Meakin led calls for fares to stay the same, arguing that proposals did not reflect the views of all taxi operators, some of whom said a hike would kill trade locally. But councillors voted 6-2 in favour of the rise. The proposals will now be advertised for further comment. Response to Roadshow. The Angus Community Resilience Roadshow, held across the county recently, drew in more than 100 people who were keen to find out more about how to be prepared in the event of serious or significant incidents. The roadshow recently visited Arbroath, Brechin, Kirriemuir and Montrose. Having toured more rural areas previously, the aim was to attract interest from more urban areas to emphasise that preparations and resilience is for town as well as country. It was attended by many organisations, including the Red Cross, Fire Service, SEPA, SSEN, Police Scotland, Trading Standards, Angus Housing Association, Scottish Neighbourhood Watch, Protecting People Angus, local community resilience groups, Angus Council Flood and Resilience Teams and community officers, Scottish Flood Forum attended with the Flow the Flood Bus. Many of those who came along were taken aback and reassured by the number of organisations that are out there to support communities when crisis or adversity strikes. It gave them a chance to engage and consult about what's required when it comes to personal and community resilience and raise the possibility of them developing a resilience group in communities. Angus Hotels take top award. Two Angus hotels were among the winners of the Oscars of the Hotel World, which was presented recently. At the ceremony for the Innis and Gunn Prestige Hotel Awards, the Glenesk Country House Hotel and Spa in Edsall came away with two. The coveted four-star Hotel North and Best Independently Owned Hotel Awards. Carnoustie Golf Hotel and Spa, meanwhile, won the Best Spa and Golf Hotel. Finalists from all over Scotland attended the ceremony, which was hosted by comedian and television personality Des Clark, and saw the cream of the hospitality industry attend. Unmarked patrols after shoplifting complaints. Police have been carrying out plainclothes patrols in areas of Carnoustie and Monifieth following complaints of shoplifting and antisocial behaviour. Reports were made by local retailers and members of the public in both towns. Officers have been patrolling an unmarked police in vehicles. A Police Scotland spokesperson said that the purpose of the initiative was threefold. The objective of these patrols is to deter criminal activity, identify offenders, and provide reassurance to the local community. Officers have been deployed in areas highlighted by both residents and businesses as locations where antisocial behaviour and criminality are taking place. And during the course of the operation, several stop and search were carried out, resulting in action being taken in relation to low-level drug offences. Trio make welcome return. On Sunday, June the 1st, Arbroath Accordion and Fiddle Club will welcome back the Jim Gold Trio as the guest band for its meeting. Jim, who plays accordion, and his brother Tom, who play fiddle, are well-respected musicians who have performed at many corporate and private events throughout the country and are popular acts at accordion and fiddle clubs. The doors at the Meadowbank Inn will open at 1 p.m. and the music starts at 1:30. The club would like to welcome younger accordion players and fiddle players, giving them an opportunity to hear live traditional music and an opportunity to play. There's a good picture of these two lads on the fiddle and accordion. Annual plant sale at Pitmuir's. The ever popular Angus plant sale took place on Saturday, May 24th in Pitmuir's garden by permission of Rory and Jeanette Ogilvie. There was a good selection of plants donated from private gardens and local nurseries. The admission was £6 and it covered entry to both the plant sale and the gardens, and children went free. The sale ran from 10 a.m. through to 1 p.m. with teas and coffees, and all proceeds go to the Scotland's Garden Scheme charity. And there's a picture of part of the garden there, and the borders look absolutely beautiful and stunning. 65,000 pounds donated to charity in the last year. The Angus Mental Health Charity Reach Across held its annual general meeting at their office in the Guthrie Port, Arbroath. The charity provides help and support to individuals and families living with mental health issues. To tackle socialisation and loneliness, volunteers run several courses in the Guthrie Port premises, offering something for everyone, and all are welcome. These include a men's group, an art class, fitness class, and instructor Mary Stewart has trained 68 people to SVQ level 5 in mental health, with more classes planned this year. The charity relies on donations, and since last year's AGM, donations have totaled £65,000. Also this year, it was successfully nominated for the King's Award for Voluntary Service for its charitable award. And there's a picture of the volunteers who have done this work in the paper as well. Recycling goods is such old hat. At Forfar Probus Club recent meeting, Dr. Richard Irvin from Arbroath had the members mystified with his speech title until he revealed that the entrepreneurship and recycling are not a modern phenomenon in this age. He is a historian researching the history of verdant works and presented a vivid picture of Alexander Thompson and his family in Dundee, who bought the factory in 1895. They had been retailers of crystal and stoneware in Victorian Road, but repurposed the former jute mill premises into refining scrap lead, zinc, brass and copper, also recycling rag waste, old cloths into fleeces for mattresses and field dressings, with a turnover of £14,000 by the early 20th century. The Thompson family were at the forefront of technology and good worker relations, with telephone and sprinkler systems installed, a 45-hour week, supplying the war effort with fabric for observation balloons, and a business intelligence system that was continually looking for new markets. This resulted in their final venture and explained Richard's talk title, lasting from the 20s till the 1950s, the trade in rabbit skins brought from all over the UK, dried, graded and exported to the US for the booming hat felt market. Some 80,000 skins crossed the Atlantic at any one time. Myxomatosis badly affected this trade and the factory closed in 1960. Members found this talk fascinating, with lots of questions before John Webster gave the formal vote of thanks. Funding to support farming community. A well-being charity, which has helped to support farmers in Angus, has been awarded £20,000 from the National Lottery Community Fund to aid its work. Farmstrong Scotland will use the cash to expand the charity's social well-being activities across farming and crofting communities in Scotland, including holding more of its popular walk and talk events. These informal days are held on a farm or croft with interested speakers and great food, and offer the opportunity for attendees to connect with others in the industry. Since they were launched last year, the walk and talks have taken place in Angus as well as Murrayshire, the Highlands, the Isle of Bute and Dumfriesshire, with all ages of the farming community attending to take part in activities such as fitness tutorials, farm tours and wild swimming. And then just a little bit of sport. First race proves team have pace to compete. Forfar driver Sandy Mitchell bagged a top six finish in the GT World Challenge Europe Sprint Pro Cup at Zandvoort, despite feeling under the weather all weekend. The 26-year-old was again partnered by Hugo Cook in the number 78 Lamborghini Huracan GT3 Evo 2 prepared by Barwell. He raced the opening 60 minutes well from 13th to 41 car grid and survived what turned out to be a bruising opening three corners as the field battled for position. Mitchell said it was a great result for the team, especially as this is not only Barwell's first full season contesting the Sprint Pro Cup, but Hugo's first in the pro class. And then we have Cameron is dominant in the Open. This is tennis. Cameron Fryer of Montrose Tennis Club won both the singles and doubles title at the Fairmount Hotel Tennis Tayside Open. Fryer beat Finley Walters of Bramford Tennis Club in the final at St Andrews, not dropping a set in the entire tournament. The Stirling University player then joined forces with Waters as they won the double title 6-3, 6-3 over David Killing and Bernard Struck. Fryer then teamed up with Stephen West to win all their three sets in the Montrose first team draw, 5-5 away against Perth 1 in Division 1. Patrick Young, another Stirling University player, and Gregor McIver won in two sets. The match was shortened because of a 10 p.m. curfew and Montrose's top pair didn't play the final round. Masson has at least one more season in him for Montrose. Terry Masson has agreed to a new 12-month deal with Montrose, extending his tenure at the club to an incredible 16 years. Arriving in June 2010 from Carnoustie Panmure, the 36-year-old midfielder is currently the club's longest-serving player. Back in December, he played his 448th game, leapfrogging Bogwy Livingston into second place at all-time appearances at the Lynx. And finally, another award for co-bosses. Colin Hamilton and David Gould have been named Scottish League One Glens Manager of the Season after leading Arbroath to the title. After being appointed as co-managers in September, Hamilton and Gould successfully lifted the Gayfield side from bottom of the league to finish 7 points clear. The pair were also recipients of two Glens Managers of the Month titles this season in both December and March. Hamilton and Gould said, "First and foremost, we want to say what an incredible honour it has been to be named as Glens Manager of the Season. Our whole outlook is togetherness and creating a solid team spirit and dressing room. So this award is dedicated to our players and staff for their talent, work ethic and unity, which have been the heartbeat of our season."
Hello, this is Jenny reading from Angus County Press, Thursday, May the 29th. The front page shows Arbroath Courthouse and the headline is £2.1 million for regeneration. Plans for the development of Arbroath's former townhouse and Gilger buildings have been given a major step towards completion with a £2.1 million grant. Arbroath Courthouse Community Trust has been working for years to redevelop the Arbroath Courthouse following a community asset transfer from the Scottish Courts Service. The project to create town centre employment, leisure and learning opportunities secured the grant funding from the Regeneration Capital Grant Fund, which is delivered in partnership between the Scottish Government and COSLA. In addition to safeguarding two important historic listed buildings, the key aims of the project are to develop a high-quality, environmentally sustainable and fully accessible mixed-use anchor building, which can respond to community needs for the future, create good quality, full and part-time jobs, and provide career development opportunities, and provide inspirational spaces for the whole community. The redeveloped properties will provide space for a mix of opportunities in enterprise, skills development, training and learning, blended with much needed community space. This funding allocation follows approval of £100,000 from the UK Shared Prosperity Community Capital Grant Fund, facilitated by Angus Council, as well as cash from other sources, including the Scottish Lottery Community Fund, Place-Based Investment Fund, Sea Green, Historical Environment Scotland, and the group's own fundraising. Rules change for cemeteries. Dogs are to be kept on leads in Angus cemeteries as councillors agree new rules aimed at curbing dog fouling. It comes after a report revealed the local authority has received multiple complaints of irresponsible behaviour by owners who have allowed their dogs to roam unchecked and foul on burial grounds. The report went before councillors on the local authorities' communities committee. The new rules mean all dogs must be kept on a short lead when visiting cemeteries in Angus. Signage will also be updated to reflect the change. However, the council will look to adopt a self-policing approach to enforcing the new rules. Promoting trusted traders. In a bid to prevent doorstep crime, Angus Trading Standards are urging residents to use the Angus Trusted Trader Scheme to safely choose a reliable local trader to carry out work in their homes. The initiative, backed by Angus Council and supported by Police Scotland, enables residents to search for reputable, vetted local businesses covering trades and services from plumbers, electricians and roofers to accountants and taxes. With many residents falling foul to rogue traders, Trading Standards are working to protect against doorstep crime and promote good practice and reliable services. All traders part of the scheme have to meet strict criteria to become a member and are fully vetted by Trading Standards, who regularly examine business practices, monitor reviews and feedback, and will intervene in disputes when required. New boat named. Montrose's new inshore lifeboat was named officially with the dedication service and launch ceremony at the weekend. The D-class lifeboat Margaret Olive arrived at the town's lifeboat station on January the 8th and has already been launched in response to 8 call-outs. Saturday's event was attended by representatives from the RNLI and the local community gathered at the station on Wharf Street. The service of dedication was followed by the naming ceremony, which was opened by Mike Neal, Lifeboat Management Group Chairman, and saw Ken Brown officially hand Margaret Olive into the care of the team at Montrose RNLI Lifeboat Station. The lifeboat has been named in memory of Mr. Brown's late wife, Margaret, who ran a dental practice in the northeast of Scotland for 28 years. She loved sailing, outdoor adventures and travelling and was a supporter of the RNLI throughout her life and was always grateful when at sea that the RNLI were available if required. The Margaret Olive will help the volunteer crew to save more lives with the ability to operate closer to the shore and in confined locations. She is also highly manoeuvrable. The D-class inshore lifeboat has been the workhorse of the RNLI for over 50 years. She is highly manoeuvrable and usually operates closer to shore than all weather lifeboats. She comes into her own for searches and rescues in the surf, shallow water and confined locations, often close to cliffs, among rocks, and even inside caves. Church check for Maggies. Karen McKinnon, head of Maggies Centre Dundee, gave an illustrated talk on her charity's work to members representing Christian denominations across Forfar. She explained that the centre, built in 2003 in the grounds of Ninewells Hospital and the first new-built centre in the UK, is a warm, welcoming place for those or someone they care about who are diagnosed with cancer. No appointment is needed and all the help is free, offering specific support groups, cancer treatment information, relaxation and stress management, all with the backup of medical professionals on call to answer questions. Following her talk, Forfar Action of Churches Together presented Karen with a cheque for £1,250, which was raised through soup lunches held during the 6 weeks of Lent leading up to Easter. Former commandos gather for reunion. A group of former serving Royal Marines who were commando engineers serving with 45 Commando at RM Conda in Arbroath from 1971 to 1987, returned to their old base at the weekend for a reunion. The members of what was 59 Troop, renamed Conda Troop, enjoyed a programme of activities during the event, which was held over Saturday and Sunday. They toured around their old haunts on base, although a few things have changed since their time there. In the evening, they enjoyed a wonderful meal in the sergeant's mess, and there is a photograph of all the people who participated in the reunion. Summer music returns. The new programme of summer music in St. Vigen's will begin on June the 1st. The first concert will feature the Canoosti Traditionals, led by Stuart Anderson, who will deliver a toe-tapping selection of Scottish music and song. Concerts will take place in the historic setting of St. Vigen's Church every Sunday afternoon in June. Next week, on June the 8th, members of Arbroath Piano Club will be joined by local soprano Elaine Taylor. The hour-long concerts start at 2:30 p.m. with admission by donation at the door and refreshments for all served in the hall. MP urges more Angus support for Ukraine. Broughty Ferry and Arbroath MP Stephen Gethins met recently with representatives from the Ukraine Embassy in London to present an Angus Council tartan tie and discuss setting up a twinning agreement between Sumy Oblast in Ukraine and Angus. These actions were further to Angus Councillor Lloyd Melville's efforts in bringing forward a motion in Angus Council which aims to secure a formal partnership between Sumy Oblast and Angus, reiterating the local authorities' support for the people of Ukraine by twinning the Ukrainian and Scottish regions. His motion, which was unanimously agreed, called on the council to unequivocally condemn the Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine and acknowledge the right of Ukraine as a sovereign nation to exist as an independent democratic state free from the threat of aggression by its neighbours. It also urged the UK government to increase aid to Ukraine to ensure it can continue to defend itself, express support for the country's brave and determined people and its military, called on the council to continue its work in welcoming and supporting people from Ukraine to settle in Angus for as long as they need to. The motion was supported unanimously by Angus Council, who entered a friendship agreement with Sumy Oblast to foster cultural ties and build civic links. Mr. Melville also last week proposed the Ukrainian flag being raised at Angus Council's headquarters in Forfar. Charity appeals for stock to boost shop. An Arbroath charity shop has put out an urgent appeal to help boost its stock to help treat sick and injured pets. Staff and volunteers at the town's PDSA shop are urging animal lovers across the area to have a clear out and donate any unwanted items they find. Donations can be taken to the shop from 9:30 to 4:30 p.m. Monday to Friday and from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on a Saturday. Located at 227 High Street, the PDSA shop raises vital funds to provide free and low-cost vet care for those who struggle to pay for treatment for their sick and injured pets. Ewan signs on at Montrose. Ewan Loudon is swapping the Highland League for League One after leaving Brechin City to sign a pre-contract with Montrose. The 21-year-old attacker joined City in August 2021, following his release from St Johnstone. He would go on to feature 136 times for the Glebe Park side, chipping in with 33 goals and 31 assists. Loudon, who has agreed to a two-year deal, added, "I'm absolutely delighted and really looking forward to the season ahead." Also departing Gleed Park are Mark Scott, who is taking a break from football following the recent birth of his son, whilst Lewis Martin has agreed a pre-contract with Forfar Athletic. Fife doubleheader for the drivers. Angus was well represented as there was a big turnout of saloons at Knockhill Trioval on Saturday afternoon. Amongst those racing were the Brechin trio of Barry and Gemma Russell and Logan Bruce, Keelan Ogilvy from Lawrencekirk and Ralph Sturrock from Monifieth. Whilst the weather was dull, there were only a few spots of rain as the heat saw G. Russell pick up a seventh place and Bruce finish in tenth. The final was chaotic with almost 40 cars on the track, resulting in the cars spinning on a regular basis. The final was won by Gary Patterson, with G. Russell the best of the Angus drivers in fifth place. This week in history. May the 31st, 1930. Don Bradman became the first Australian to score 1,000 runs in England by the end of May. June the 1st, 1831. The magnetic North Pole was located by St. James Clark Ross on his Arctic exploration expedition with Admiral Parry. June the 3rd, 1978. The Guinness Book of Records went into the Guinness Book of Records as the most stolen book from British libraries. June the 4th, 1977. Damage estimated at £15,000 was caused when fans dug up the Wembley pitch after Scotland beat England 2-1. June the 4th, 2024. A 25-year-old woman was arrested on suspicion of assault after a milkshake was thrown at Reform UK leader Nigel Farage following a campaign event in Essex.
Hello, this is Julie reading from the Angus County Press from Thursday, June the 5th. 70k project is complete by Mark Dowie. A major £70,000 upgrade of visitor facilities in Glenclova has been completed in a joint project by Angus Council and the Cairngorms National Park Authority. The work at the popular Milton of Clova car park has been finished off in time for the busy summer season, and aims to provide a high quality experience to visitors while managing their impacts through providing better infrastructure. Improvements to path, cycle and outdoor access networks will give enhanced opportunities to experience the natural and cultural heritage of the national park to as wide a range of people as possible, including facilities suitable for wheelchair users. At the same time, there is an intention to minimise disturbance to vulnerable species, habitats and sites. The project has focused on existing flooding issues and taking measures to maximise available parking bays. Existing concrete steps, which were in a poor condition and restrictive, have been replaced with an easily accessible zigzag pathway that offers a comfortable, gentle gradient for people of all physical abilities to get to and from the car park. Improved accessible paths and car parking means that users with mobility issues can move around the site more easily and access the existing toilets. New picnic tables, including wheelchair accessible tables, have been installed on firm paved bases next to and close to paths, where visitors can relax and take refreshments after a day of enjoying the national park. Village table sale. Kingsmuir Village Hall will be the venue on June 14th for a fundraising table sale to help with its upkeep. The hall is well supported by various organisations who meet there weekly, including the Table Tennis Club, BeFit Exercise Class, Shona's Wellness Class, U3A Wellness Class, the Notables Choir and a puppy training class on. The local SWI also meets there once a month. Given its level of use, the hall committee has to maintain the premises to a high standard, which the sale will help to support. The event will run between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. and there are still places available for anyone wishing to rent a table. The committee will also man a barbecue and there will also be tea, coffee and biscuits and a raffle. For further details of activities or if you would like to rent a table on the day, visit the Village Hall Facebook page for details. Pupils Get Taste of Military Life by Mark Dowie. Secondary pupils from across Angus were recently given a glimpse into life in the armed forces during a visit to 4-5 Commando at their Arbroath base. The day-long visit, which involved pupils from Arbroath High, Arbroath Academy, Carnoustie High, Monifieth High, Forfar Academy, Webster's High and Brechin High and Montrose Academy, was part of an annual initiative run by the Lord Lieutenant's Office. Every year, the Angus Lieutenancy hosts its Spirit of Adventure Day, in which secondary pupils are guests of Pat Sawyers, Lord Lieutenant of Angus, who this year was assisted by Deputy Lieutenant Debbie Porter and 4-5 Commando Duty Officer Lieutenant Luke Bradley. The annual initiative started as part of the Queen's Diamond Jubilee celebrations in 2012, when youngsters completed 6 different walks through Glen Clover and Glen Prosen. The lucky pupils took part in various activities under the supervision of highly trained Royal Marines. These included wall climbing in the Ben Novak Sports Centre, a demonstration of various weapons, none were loaded, and a demonstration of the field ration packs, kit bags and a jackal armoured vehicle. Both the teachers and pupils enjoyed a wonderful lunch in the golf pavilion before returning to activities in the afternoon. At the end of the day, one pupil from each school was offered a free place next year at the Outdoor Ridgeway Adventure Centre, Ardmore, North West Scotland. And there's 2 good pictures of the children with their ration packs and some of the gear on, and also at the climbing wall. Visit for update on £66 million Monifieth Campus project. Angus Council leader George Meakin and senior officers visited the new Monifieth Learning Campus site recently to see the significant progress on the £66.5 million project. The campus, being built next to the current Monifieth High School, has been designed as a modern, inclusive facility to meet the needs of children and young people and will offer a 25-metre swimming pool, theatre and performance spaces, flexible classrooms, early learning and childcare facilities and extensive sports amenities. The project is part of Phase 2 of the National Learning Estate Investment Programme, with capital funding provided by Angus Council and revenue support from the Scottish Government upon completion. Construction began in May 2023 and remains on schedule to open to young people in August 2025 and within budget. The campus has been built by Robertson Construction Tayside through Procurement Hub's Major Projects Framework 2. First Place for Frog Pick by Mark Dowie. The photography skills of a Montrose Academy pupil have helped him to take the top prize in an environmental journalism competition. Archie Shepherd won an environmental charity Keep Scotland Beautiful's Young Reporters for the Environment competition, with his entry One Hidden Frog, which was selected as the winner in the single photo 15 to 18 age category. Katrina Ray, Senior Education and Learning Officer, said, "Every year we are blown away by the amazing entries we receive from young people who show just how passionate they are about environmental issues through writing, photography and videos. It's never easy to select a winner out of such brilliant submissions, and the wider team all cast their votes to choose who deserved the top prize. I'd like to congratulate Archie as well as all our other winners and entrants for their fantastic pieces. We have been running this competition for a number of years now, and it's amazing to see such continued passion and enthusiasm from young people all over the country. Young Reporters for the Environment is an environmental journalism programme and competition that gives young people the opportunity to speak on environmental issues they feel strongly about through writing, photography and videos." And there's a lovely picture of the winning entry from Archie, One Hidden Frog, which shows a close-up picture of a frog hidden in some grass. Tales of Hospital Ward Life. Angus Theatre fans are in for a very special evening later this year as the nation's 12th favourite doctor, Adam Kay, brings his hilarious undoctored tour to Whitehall Theatre. Fresh from a record-breaking run at the Edinburgh Fringe, where it was the best-selling show of 2023 and a sell-out season in the West End, the hit tour brings Adam's unique tales of life on and off the wards to the stage in an evening that will have his audience laughing and crying. Adam's previous book, This Is Going to Hurt, was a literary sensation, selling 3 million copies and becoming a multi-BAFTA-winning BBC series. Undoctored follows on from This Is Going to Hurt with Adam's unique tales of life on and off the wards. It also contains the degloving story because people ask for refunds if they do not hear it. Tickets for the show on September 28th are available from the theatre box office and online at www.whitehalltheatre.com. Former Brechin Factory, Up for Sale by Mark Dowie. A former blind factory in Brechin has been put on the market after the firm collapsed, leading to 50 members of staff losing their jobs just before Christmas. A buyer has been sought for the former home of Stephen Scotland. Production at the family-run company ended last year after more than 50 years, with the former bosses blaming the decision on a downturn in UK sales. They said the company had struggled against reduced consumer spending on homes due to the cost of living crisis. The company's Denburn Way factory is now on the market, with the price of the property not publicly displayed but available on application to the seller. Arbuthnot Garden opening. Arbuthnot House will welcome the public this weekend as part of Scotland's Garden Schemes. The seat of the Viscount of Arbuthnot, whose family has lived at Arbuthnot near Inverbervie since 1190, its 5-acre garden will be open on Sunday, June the 8th, between 2 and 5 p.m. It was laid out in the 17th century and comprises a walled garden with some 1920s arts and crafts planting. Thought to be one of the oldest gardens in Scotland, it runs down a steep south-facing slope divided by 3 main broadwalks. Beds are bound by topiary, herbaceous borders, rose beds and long beds for cut flowers. Admission is £5, children go free, with proceeds going to UNICEF UK and SGS charities. Due to the steep layout, the gardens are not wheelchair accessible. Crowds turn out for market. Arbroath Market was held at the town's Victoria Park on Sunday, attracting crowds despite the weather. From soft fruit and locally grown vegetables to honey and craft gin, the market again attracted some of the best producers that the Arbroath and wider Angus areas have to offer. In addition to the wide variety of stalls, there was also a bouncy castle for the children, and the youngsters were even allowed to sit in a Police Scotland pursuit vehicle, wear a policeman's hat and switch on the emergency blue lights. Despite a couple of torrential rain showers, the sun did finally make an appearance and the market was well attended. The next market will be on Sunday, July 27th, and details and updates can be found on the market's Facebook page. And there's a lovely picture of a Constable Joe Gregg with 3 young children sitting in the police car and wearing the police hats. Dancers Win Champions Title by Mark Dowie. Teams from Notorious Dance in Arbroath recently brought home an impressive haul of trophies after competing in the Scottish Dance Event competition. The dance school took 48 dancers, along with 50 of their parents or guardians, to the competition in Glasgow's Royal Concert Hall. Notorious Dance had qualified to compete at the competition, where they would compete in hip-hop, lyrical, commercial and jazz dance. Six teams competed along with entries in the solo, duet and quad sections. In the hip-hop competition, teams Chaos, Authority and Collision all took first place and were named as Scottish champions in the discipline. In the lyrical section, Team Euphoria were second place runners-up, while in the jazz competition, Wildcats were second place runners-up also. In the commercial team section, Reminisce were also second place runner-up. In addition, the school also came home with 48 other trophies for solo, duos and quads, including youngest dancers Ella Stewart and Eva Neeland, both seven, who won first place for their duet. Kimberly Gallagher, notorious dance principal, praised all the competitors for their hard work and their trophy success in the competition. She said, "We worked so hard for this and our results really do make all that hard work so worth it. I'm so proud of all of my dancers. They are all so talented and really did Arbroath proud this weekend." Watson signs on at City to add his experience, by Brian Newell. Montrose legend Paul Watson has signed for Brechin City to become the club's new player assistant manager. The 39-year-old midfielder departed Lynx Park after 13 seasons at the end of the season, but he wasn't ready to hang up his boots just yet. Watson will now use his experience on and off the pitch to try and help City return to the SPFL. City boss Ray McKinnon told the club's website, "I'm delighted to get Paul on board. He's an experienced player who has had a great career. He's now making the step into a coaching role and he'll still do us a great turn as player. He'll be a terrific asset for us." City also tied up Fraser McLeod, Killian Sheridan and Ryan Ferguson on new one-year deals. McKinnon said, "I'm very happy to have Killian for next season. Along with being a top player, he brings great experience to lead the line. He did brilliantly towards the end of the season and I'm looking forward to working with him again. It's great news Fraser has committed himself to the club. He is a very talented player who connects the game very well from back to front. We are delighted he wants to help get the club back to where it belongs. Delighted to have Ryan sign again. He's a talented player who's also versatile in a few positions. Ryan is a top professional and exactly the type we need at the club." Sean signs on for one more year, by Brian Yule. Sean Dillon celebrated making his 300th appearance for Montrose by signing a 12-month contract extension. Since joining in 2017 from Dundee United, the 41-year-old has offered invaluable leadership, experience and consistency, now splitting his time between playing and coaching duties. Dillon, who made his 300th appearance away to Alloa Athletic in April, said, "I'm delighted to be staying at the club. It was an easy decision for me. The 8 seasons I've been here have all had their challenges, but the togetherness and family feel that everyone creates here makes it so enjoyable. I wasn't aware of the 300th appearance against Alloa until the gaffer mentioned it in his team talk. Fair to say they haven't all been great performances, but I'm keen to add to that number when we get back to it after the break." Mitchell has to settle for coming 6th in Monza, by Jim McGill. Forfar driver Sandy Mitchell bagged a top 6 finish in the GT World Challenge Europe Endurance Pro Cup in the latest round at Monza. The 25-year-old and his Italian Vincenzo Spiri racing team had to fight back through the field after unfortunately falling victim to an ill-timed full course yellow period. Partnered by Frenchman Frank Pereira and Italian Mattia Michelotti in the number 163 Lamborghini Huracan Evo 2 GT3, Mitchell looked on as Pereira started the three-hour race from fourth on the 59-car grid. Just seconds into the race came the first of 8 interruptions involving combinations of FCYs and safety cars, was triggered when an Aston Martin was pitched into the gravel on the opening lap. With the field restricted to 80 kilometres per hour rather than full race speed, those making their pit stops under the caution period benefited by more than 2 minutes. Mitchell explained, "It was just really unfortunate timing. It meant that cars we'd been ahead of could pit and rejoin ahead of us because we were trundling round at 80 kilometres per hour. When the race went green again after the 20-minute caution period, Mitchell's number 163 Lamborghini had dropped to 17th. Mitchell added, "It's certainly not what we deserve because Frank hadn't put a foot wrong through his stint. Not only did he avoid any trouble at the race start, which is traditionally hectic at Monza, he also safely negotiated another three restarts after safety car periods. I think we definitely had the pace for a top five finish, possibly a podium. At the end, we were lapping as fast as the lead cars, but circumstances out with our control impacted our race. Mitchell's next European race is the Spa 24 Hours with VSR on June 27th to 29th. Anything above 8th is a bonus, says new chairman. Arbroath chairman Brian Cargill says anything above an 8th place finish next season in the championship is a bonus. Cargill, who took over from Ewan West last month, says the main focus is on stability after winning the League One title to achieve promotion. He told Arbroath FC TV, "The immediate short-term goal is stability. We're not being negative in any way, but 8th spot has to be our initial aim and anything above that's a bonus. That's not saying we're going up there to be 8th, we're going up there to finish as high the league as we can, but we have to stay in the championship and that's what we're focusing all our efforts on just now. We're working hard behind the scenes, there's work going on at the ground to improve it for next season and there's work with the managers to bring in more quality players to give us the best shot at staying in this league and having a really good season." Cargill is excited to work with Paul Reid, who became the club's CEO almost exactly a year ago, and the rest of the board. And finally, "Murdy Stands Down at Athletic" by Brian Newell. Forfar Athletic chairman Scott Murdy stood down following last week's AGM after 5 years in the role. Murdy has agreed to remain a director of the club, with Alan Shepherd taking over reins as chairman. Murdy told the club's website it has been an honour to serve as chairman of Forfar Athletic over the past 5 years. "I would like to express my heartfelt thanks to my partner Leslie, who has been a power of support throughout my time in the role. I'm also extremely grateful to Forfar Athletic's supporters, sponsors and all my fellow directors, past and present, for their help, guidance and commitment. I also wish to thank our players, past and present. It has certainly been a challenging period for the club, but I believe that we're in a great position to rebuild and to come back stronger now. I have full confidence in Alan Shepherd as the new chairman and in the current board. Their experience and dedication give me great hope for the future. I also have every belief that Jim Weir and Gavin Price are the right management team to take the club forward. With everyone working together, I'm optimistic that Forfar Athletic is on the road to better times."
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
My guest, and I'm very pleased to meet her and to be able to interview her, is Mrs. Olga Hopkins, who very recently visited Buckingham Palace for a reason that we're going to discover a bit later. But before we get there, can we go back to the beginning? Because you lived in interesting times. You were born in the 20s.
I was. Yes, I was born in Monmouthshire. My father was a miner. Having served all the way through the First World War, he came back and there was nothing else to do in South Wales. He had no other qualifications and so he became a miner. They were very, very poor indeed. I remember it still vividly. By the 1930s, things had got a little better, but not much. I can really tell you with some pride that in 1937, my father must have been one of the very few Conservatives in South Wales, and he was asked to try and form a Conservative Miners' Union. Very foolishly, he accepted the challenge. Of course, he lost. And while the campaign was on, my mother and I were sent away for our own safety. So, you know, that was exciting. I remember 1939 and the growing anxiety and the inevitability that there was going to be war. And I do remember that awful morning. at 11 o'clock when Mr. Chamberlain said that we are at war with Germany. My father said, about bloody time, and my mother cried, and I was very bewildered. By then, we had moved further south to the lovely Vale of Glamorgan, and I was at school at a very small but very good girls' grammar school, Cowbridge High School then, is now an enormous comprehensive. My O-level, whatever we called it then, was really quite good. And so I went to a different school, a mixed school, Tonerevel Grammar School, and there was doing my higher school certificate. At the same time, I was a member of the Women's Junior Air Corps, a girls' equivalent of the ATC, and it was very good and I enjoyed it immensely. I could tell you the aeroplanes of the British Air Force and also the German ones. We distinguished by, we said, by sound, but we thought we knew what they looked like. I also did Morse code and some wonderful marching, at which the girls were very good. By Christmas of 1943, I was feeling a bit fed up with things, and I went into Cardiff and joined the WAF, just like that. And then I went home and told my father, who seemed rather proud. My mother cried again. I don't want to give a picture that she was a weak lady. She wasn't, I can assure you. She was lovely. So in January 1944, my father took me to Cardiff Station, 7:30 in the morning, to become a WAF.
And where did you go to from Cardiff?
In Turnhill, in Shropshire, where we did square bushing, which again I loved. And we had things like medicals. Now, that was very difficult for me, having gone to a girls' school where there weren't any showers, so we didn't have them, where nudity was a very, very private thing indeed. But when you're living communally, it's a different world. And we had to have what they called FFIs, which are free from infection. So half-stripped and look to see if you had any impetigo and things like that and nits in your hair and so on, and a general examination in a room with several other people. And I found that difficult. And then later on, this was all in one day. Later on, we had three injections, for one for cholera, one for tetanus, and one for malaria, I think. The next day, we had aptitude and intelligence tests. I think the Air Force used the Raven's test. And after a while, this was marked, and somebody said, "You stand over there," to somebody else, "You stand over there." Anyway, I went in that corner, and I was more or less alone for most of it. And then they said, "Oh, you're going to be a wireless mechanic." Well, I think I laughed, really, which was usually my response to surprising things. A wireless mechanic entailed going to Glasgow Royal Technical School and the university for 6 months, followed by an intensive further 4 months in RAF Cranwell. In 1944, in June, we were in Glasgow and we were having our coffee break. And suddenly a man came in waving a newspaper and he said, "D-Day, D-Day has landed." And we cheered like mad. It was only far later in the day that we had some inkling of how awful that delay landing must have been and the number of casualties. After that, I went to a small station called Church Lawford, and then soon went to Wellesbourne Mountford, where we had rather old bombers, Ansons and Blenheims. What I had to do, or we had to do rather, was a daily inspection, having got up at 6:30 and a mass breakfast and things. We then had to go out to the flight, and you'd been given a list of the numbers or the letters of planes. And so you got in the bomber and then you tuned them. If they were working properly, that was fine. And then you called up the watchtower and said, "How do you read me?" You'd say, "Was it 1 to 5? And if they said fine, that was fine. If they said anything else, there was work to be done in the plane. So we either retuned, if we could, and caught the tower again, and that would probably be all right because they were usually pretty minor faults. And then you'd test all the wiring in the plane and all the outlets, the press-to-talk buttons. If anything didn't work, you either mended the buttons and things like that in situ, and you just carried the set back to the section. And then if there was any fault to be discovered, we would do that in the afternoon and then replace it so that it would be serviceable the next day. And then on my 21st birthday, I was moved to RAF Spitalgate. So on my important birthday then, I didn't have a card and I didn't have a present, but I was moved. My parents hadn't heard about moving and had to tell them afterwards. We were a small group moved together, and we were pretty fed up, I can tell you. But we went to a party that night when we got to Spitalgate in Lincolnshire. There was a dance. There's always a dance in the Air Force. And we had a lovely big band and dancing, and I was a bit down in the dumps. But we had a flight of Dutch Air Force cadets come over from Amsterdam, and they were about to get their wings, I think, on our station at Spitalgate. So I told one of them, well, I'm really miserable, and so on. And so he told the whole lot, and then I had a whale of a time, and the party was memorable, shall we say. This station was the final kind of training for pilots, and we had a very fine aeroplane, a Harvard American plane, and then we had some Spitfires, and that, of course, was the dream of anybody to have to go in here. But I suppose I must have done to have tested the wiring in the nose. It was so beautiful that it was a privilege just to be there, really, to see both planes, which were very, very fine. Soon we came to the 7th of May because we were lying in bed. Perhaps we knew that something, you know, the war was coming to a critical time, and we were on our bed and listening to the American Forces Network, the glamorous WAF pyjamas in blue and white flannel and so on. And suddenly on the tannoy, there came an announcement. The war is over. The war is over. It's going to be signed tomorrow. The war's over. And we all jumped up and we were sort of screaming, and wasn't it wonderful? And then somebody said, oh, it's a party at the sergeant's mess. So off we went, put our battle dress over our pyjamas and went up to the sergeant's mess and had a lovely party. I remember the band again, and we danced. I think I sang something, Don't Fence Me In. And then on the next day, we all went back to the section. We were flying again, and then in the afternoon we did stop and listen to Churchill. So that was VE Day for me in 1945.
And that's why it's so important to you. You didn't go home during your time, did you?
I didn't go home until June the 7th, 1947. So I had two further years in what was a war service. We waited until the August when the war in Japan finished, but not until after the Hiroshima bomb had dropped. And then, I'm afraid to say, we all cheered like mad. And then we began to have thoughts when the second one was dropped in Nagasaki. But we were glad because the Japanese, we felt, would never have surrendered unless something like that had happened to them. They would have gone on. You know, it was unthinkable that they should surrender. One of my best friends, who became my husband, Alan Hopkins, he was at the time on his way to the Far East in a cruiser. He landed in Sydney on the very day that the bomb dropped. And then after a few months of swanning around in Australia, the cruiser did a flag-waving tour of the Far East. So you name it in the Far East, he went there. The personnel who had served longest, and they were either brought home, a lot of them had been in Germany and Italy and had a pretty tough time, and they were demobbed first, as was right. I think because it had taken so long to train wireless mechs and radar mechs as well, that they weren't in a hurry to get rid of us, but they were right to get rid of the men who had served, as I've said. But the time went on and on and on, and the joys of service, like I must say, became a little bit stale by the end. I'm sure I blotted my copybook in more than one way. They used to publish the demob number every month. One got very, very anxious knowing that the number was coming up. It did at last come up. It came up in May that I was to be demobbed.
Now, I said I'd take you back to the beginning because I discovered that you had been to Buckingham Palace. You mentioned VE Day.
Yes.
As a day you remember very vividly war experience. Tell me what happened. Why were you at Buckingham
Palace?
Well,
my three children, unfortunately, Judith died. She would have been included, I'm sure. My three children heard the advertisement on the radio, and so they contacted the British Legion, and a wonderful woman called Emma became our chief correspondent, and everything fell in place from there. And then they said, would you like to go to Buckingham Palace? So I thought, in for a penny, in for a pound. I said, yes, I'd love to. I'd never having been there. And so I did, to the tea party. David organised a limousine to take Catherine and me there, and we went to a hotel, and they took us to the palace in small coaches. There were about 50 of us, I think. And then we were led onto the terrace, which is below the balcony. You know, the king and the royal family were all there. The crowds and the parade had come up the Mall. And then we saw the flypast just above us, straight over us, and that was thrilling. And then afterwards we went into a long, like a reception room, a rather plain room, but it was laid out with very, very long table too. And they had white tablecloths and food placed at intervals and told, you know, just sit down, sit where you like. And so we did. Very soon after that, the king and the queen and the prince and princess, Princess Anne and her husband, and Prince George, they all came in. We were not asked to stand. There was no trumpeting, nothing. It just came in and started to mix at once. Also came in without any announcements, the top four, I think, of the government, Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, and again, no announcements when they came in. Nobody had to stand or salute or whatever. And then after that, the heads of all the armed forces came in. I might say that amongst the guests, I loved this part, amongst the guests, there were people who'd served in the forces, evacuees, fire watchers, firemen, policemen, air raid wardens, people who worked on balloons and so on. Everybody had been contacted by the British Legion, and those who'd responded were there. And we all sat at these tables, and I realised soon that I was on the wrong side of the table because I was looking at Prince George sitting there just opposite. You couldn't speak to them across the table because that wouldn't have been polite. A little while later, an equerry came and tapped me on the shoulder and said, Her Majesty the Queen would like to speak to someone who served in the armed forces, a lady who worked in the armed forces. So did you? I said, yes, I was a WAF. And so she said, would you be prepared to do it? I said, of course. And then Queen Camilla came, and my daughter stood up and stood behind me. And then she sat down and held out her hand, which I touched. And I said, it's an honour, Mom. And she said, no, no, the honour is mine to meet those who served during the war. So tell me about yourself. We talked for, it seemed ages, and it was about 5 or 10 minutes for a long time, and had the feeling she'd have gone on, really, but her equerry came and said it was time she moved on. And then after that, I had a long conversation with his name, I think, was Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Knighton, who was the head of the Air Force. Well, I mean, he was charming, and there was no ceremony, no sitting to attention or anything like that, if you could sit to attention. But he again was very, very interested, particularly interested in the fact that I had been influenced by the junior air corps, thinking how important now the ATC is. And also he asked the same things that the Queen had most interested. And then we met a rear admiral who was called Timothy Lawrence. And my daughter, who seems to know about these things, says, "He's Princess Anne's husband." We did have an interesting and humorous chat for some time with him. And the whole day was just lovely. It was such a happy day. And to me, being in that room with people from the King and the head of the forces and the head of the government, all there, and us, the hoi polloi, all there. And that's what democracy is. That's what we fought for.
Thank you very much indeed.
It's a pleasure.
TNS Soundings.